The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone. Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Lots to get to on today's program. Some really, some educational sound bites as well that we'll be playing for you a little bit later on in the show. Well, I don't know if I should begin with Anthony Kennedy's retirement or Germany getting bounced from the World Cup. Shocking news in Europe. The winner of the last World Cup didn't even make it to the final 16 teams. So for our German listeners, sorry. This is a day of mourning for them, I suppose. But in any event, it's been an interesting World Cup, the bits and pieces that I've seen. We've got another get-together tonight over at the McDonald's, by the way, to watch England square off against Belgium, I think it is. In any event, the news, Anthony Kennedy stepping down or at least retiring in July. And really, I think before I get to that, I mean, I just want to reiterate a couple of points that I made on yesterday's program. This I didn't bring this out yesterday, but there was a headline a day or two ago saying that 31% of America or Americans, 31% of Americans believe there's another civil war coming in the next 5 years, if you can believe it. That's a third of the country. Now, there are those who say, well, there's these sources or those sources that are just throwing the Civil War references out there. I mentioned the tweet by Carolyn Glick yesterday. I mean, it hasn't been this divided since 1861, she said. And some are saying, well, people are just trying to be provocative or to get clicks on their website. But I mean, this is America. 31%, a third of Americans, believe another civil war is likely in the next 5 years. I mean, they see the sharp, angry, bitter division. Now, we know, because of what your Bible prophesies, we know that great tribulation is coming. An end time period of suffering on a scale never experienced in human history. Matthew 24 brings that out. Daniel 12 and verse 1. Jeremiah 30. Now that tribulation begins, as we now know, we've known this for the last few years, that tribulation begins with, well, not just with an attack. That's part of it a little bit later on in the tribulation. But it begins, as my father has explained, with our nations being attacked economically, and then the social division together with it, an economic and social siege, as he has said before. And I'll leave it to you to study through Ezekiel chapter 4 and Ezekiel chapter 5. But here we are in this period of a temporary resurgence. I referred to that article yet again yesterday about how that if Hillary Clinton had been elected, all of these destructive trends that we saw during 8 years of Barack Obama, they would have continued unchecked, as my father has said. They would have intensified. And it would have meant the end of our constitutional republic. That's the truth. Now, my father says, you know, Mr. Trump obviously is not a perfect human being. He has some serious problems himself. But this war, you see it with all the investigations. We've pointed that out. You see it with policies. You see it with decisions. You see it with respect to immigration, the border crisis. And now you're going to see it come to the forefront in the form of this war over that Supreme Court seat, filling Anthony Kennedy's seat. And as you might have noticed yesterday when the announcement was made, you had all kinds of sources, individuals on the left, the radical left, just absolutely melting down over this news because they know that it's in the control of President Trump and a Republican-dominated Senate. Well, they don't dominate it. It's a very slim majority. But still, the Republicans are in control. And you have all these progressives, these individuals that really have barely concealed their contempt for the Constitution in years past. And now all of a sudden they're saying, our Constitution's under attack. Our Constitution. We're worried about the Constitution. This is what Senator Kamala Harris from California, here's what she had to say on MSNBC last night, clip 7.
We're looking at a destruction of the Constitution of the United States, as far as I can tell, based on all of the folks that he's been appointing thus far for lifetime appointments. He's been appointing ideologues. He has been appointing people who have refused to agree that Brown v. Board of Education is settled law. He has been appointing people who haven't even been found to be well qualified or even qualified by bar associations. So this has got to be and we all need to understand this, to be one of the most serious fights that we have yet to have had with this president. And we cannot relent. We are going to have to fight to the end to make sure that we can do anything and everything that is possible to require this president to choose a consensus pick. Talk to Democrats. The position is going to be filled. But with the track record that he has demonstrated so far, it does not look good. And so we're going to have to put all the pressure that we possibly can to make sure that the person who fills Kennedy's seat is someone who is a consensus pick and who's going to respect the Constitution of the United States and respect the fact that our system is supposed to be about equality for all and justice and fairness.
Who would have ever thought a few years ago that they'd view Donald Trump, of all people, as this right-wing ideologue? He's a right-winger. He's an extremist. He was on NBC for 14 years. I've made this point before. 14 years, the right-wing ideologue. He was on one of the big three networks, year after year after year. And now, I mean, he's in danger. We're in danger of seeing this constitutional republic come to an end because of Donald Trump, not Barack Obama. Donald Trump, and as you heard there, we've got to do anything and everything to resist. You've heard about the resistance. You've heard all the statements, even in the investigations. We'll stop him. We'll resist him. We'll take out an insurance policy. And now what are they going to do here? Well, as we'll look at in a little bit later in the show, what have they been doing for the past 30 years? I think it'll give us some pretty good insight into the kinds of things that they might resort to. Here's Chris Matthews, also of MSNBC. Here's what he said last night, clip 8.
I tell you, the Democratic base is wired now for a revolt. This will be the trigger for it. If they allow this, they shouldn't have a meeting with any of his nominees. They shouldn't have any hearings. They shouldn't show up for any hearings. They should fight this tooth and nail.
Don't even show up. No meetings, nothing. Fight it. No unity, just division. And then all the other reactions that you've seen online and elsewhere. Senator Bob Menendez, he said that with Kennedy's retirement, reproductive rights and newly gained LGBTQ rights, don't forget the Q, lie in the hands of an extremist president. He's an extremist, Donald Trump. I call upon the American people to rise up. Make your voices heard. Tell the Senate that you will not accept another extreme Supreme Court justice. Gorsuch was extremist, an extremist. And we can't have another one. And so he's calling them to rise up, not unlike Nancy Pelosi, who, as you heard in that montage I played yesterday, I mean, she can't understand why there aren't more uprisings. Maxine Waters is out there calling for people to confront Republicans in restaurants and gas stations. You bring a crowd, she said. Al Sharpton says, we have no choice but to organize. strategize, vote, and act. Ambivalent attitudes are not an option. You can't be ambivalent on this. You have to pick a side, he said. Which side are you on? It's one against the other. That's where we are today in the United States of America. Another liberal activist, an author, Elaine Atwell, she said, we may have just left the point at which we could rely on democratic norms to fix our government and are now on the road to literal revolution. Just another liberal author, that's all. She sees a future revolution, just like 31% of Americans. This is from the National Women's Law Center. This is a threat to our democracy. We cannot stress how important it is to make sure a fair-minded justice who upholds civil rights is nominated to the Supreme Court. This is a lifetime appointment, it says. The decisions made and shaped by this new justice will impact generations. Adding another Trump extremist will absolutely ensure that decisions like these are the norm for the potentially generations to come. We can't let this happen. There's a lot of them that think that way. We cannot let it happen. And then one last one here from the Style magazine editor or writer. She contributes to the piece or the magazine. She said, if you're a woman and a friend of mine with a birthday coming up soon, I'm getting you an abortion for a present while I still can enjoy it. Isn't that nice? So that's the kind of thing you see circulating around in the radical left. Donald Trump is a threat to the Constitution. Donald Trump is an extremist. Neil Gorsuch is an extremist. As I say, it wasn't that long ago when they were openly talking about, look, we've got to abandon the Constitution. This is a document that was composed by slave owners, some of them. And it's old. It's an old document. We're living in the 21st century. We've got to start making decisions for ourselves and stop deferring to this outdated piece of parchment. That's what they were saying. That was what they were saying during the days of Obama. I mean, it's just a charter of negative liberties. I mean, we need something that's positive. We need something that's modern. We had an article in the Trumpet magazine just last summer, Andrew Miller. He wrote, Convicting the Constitution. It says here, a majority of millennials view Donald Trump as an illegitimate president. They do not care what the Constitution says about electoral votes. I mean, Hillary Clinton just trashed the Electoral College the other day. They don't care about what the Constitution says. They just want Trump gone, as it says in the article. Democratic National Committee Chairman Tom Perez is tapping into this frustration. Days before Gorsuch's confirmation, this is again last summer, Perez said any Supreme Court nominee named by Mr. Trump would be illegitimate until the Federal Bureau of Investigation rules out potential ties between Trump's campaign and alleged Russian meddling in the 2016 presidential election. And we've got to wait until the investigation's up. Well, now there's nothing that's come from it. It's not over yet, but there's nothing that's come out. Certainly nothing that connects the Trump campaign to the Russians. But really, what's behind this is just their hatred for Donald Trump. It's anything and everything he does we have to resist, using any and every kind of means. Where's this leading, as I said yesterday? Andrew Miller says here, Senator Jeff Merkley went a step further on March 30th, this is last year. He said any Republican attempt to confirm Gorsuch that alters Senate procedures would mean every future 5-4 Supreme Court decision would be illegitimate. Now, we've had a number of them this week that have come down more in the favor of conservatives. But those aren't legitimate rulings. Those are illegitimate. in the mind of this senator in Congress. The same senator tweeted out yesterday, "This is a disaster for everyone who believes in the we the people vision of the Constitution." Now he's holding up the Constitution. Because now, according to him, it's the Trump people. They're trying to destroy or trash the Constitution. Andrew Miller concludes here, "Such allegations are not aimed at disparaging Gorsuch as a person. They are meant to delegitimize the entire philosophy of judicial restraint for which Gorsuch stands." What happens when millions of young Americans believe that their government is illegitimate? What happens? Yes, where is it leading? When you have millions upon millions of Americans that believe the government's illegitimate. Well, yesterday I mentioned, I believe I did, Revelation 12. Satan cast down after this war in heaven. There's no place for him found anymore in heaven, as it says in Revelation 12. He's cast to this earth. And he's deceiving the whole world. He's deceiving the whole world. My father wrote in The Hidden Cause of Society's Decline. I can't remember if this is a chapter in one of our booklets, but in any event, it was in The Trumpet back in March 2013. And it says here, "He is sitting on the throne of this earth, ruling this world," speaking of the devil. "He's stirring up people's emotions, moods, and attitudes." It says when people get into a negative emotion, a bad attitude, or a wrong mood, he works on those people. Don't even talk to them. Don't even sit down with them. You fight them. You think Satan's taking advantage of this? He sure is. This is a disaster. This is the end of our republic. It says, when people get into a negative emotion, well, I read that. He says further, he has power to influence these wrong emotions. He has deceived the world through them. People don't understand God's word. They don't have any depth spiritually. So they just follow along emotionally. And Satan just deceives them all. I mean, it's just one after another after another. The Russia, the obstruction of justice, then we got to switch over to this pornography star, then we've got to switch over to the immigration crisis. Now it's the vacant seat at the Supreme Court, and the nightmare that it'll be if there's another extremist. Satan is a master at deception. He's been cast down to this earth, and he's confined to the earth, and he knows, as Revelation 12 continues to say, he knows he has but a short time. Just a very short time before Jesus Christ returns to this earth and removes him from off the throne of this earth. And finally makes it known to all of mankind that they've been worshiping him, not the God of our Creator God, the God who created the universe. But they've been worshiping the God of this world, and he is full of wrath. As I say, he knows his time is about up. But then listen to this statement. This is, again, from that same article, The Hidden Cause of Society's Decline. I think this might be in America Under Attack. In any event, my father says here, "An event occurred in 1986 that marked a major turning point in history. It has radically altered everything that has happened since. Culture, family, education, religion, science, finance, politics, international relations, everything we do. It has affected the United States in a massive way. Yet what is most remarkable is that almost no one even knows it happened." Something happened in 1986. He's referring to Satan being cast down. And so when you look back over these past several decades, when you look back over the past 30-some years, I mean, God gives us this insight. We can look at this course we've been on and point to some very interesting events, to say the least. Anthony Kennedy was confirmed to the Supreme Court in early 1988, I believe. And this was after a very angry and bitter and contentious confirmation process over Robert Bork in 1987. And when we come back, we'll look at some of that history, as I say, fascinating history in light of that statement that I just read to you. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
To America's founding fathers, character meant everything to the success of the nation and its leadership. The Constitution was based upon the fundamental principles of religion and morality. These were the primary building blocks of the American nation. George Washington said, "The foundations of our national policy will be laid in the pure and immutable principles of private morality." Character was no minor issue to America's first president. He regarded it as the basis of national policy. Where did the founding fathers develop these ideas? Many of these principles stemmed from the Holy Scriptures. The Bible provided early Americans with the instruction and guidance of how to properly govern one's life. These beliefs helped build a nation of strong families and upright leaders. Today, America has dismissed the Bible as the foundation of developing righteous character. Men now leave it to themselves to determine right from wrong. Where has the rejection of biblically based principles led this nation? There is a cause for these effects. To understand the course of events that have led this nation to its current state, visit thetrumpet.com and click on the literature tab to request our free booklet, Character in Crisis.
From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Fleury.
President Ronald Reagan nominated Anthony Kennedy for the Supreme Court on November 11th, 1987. And as the American Spectator wrote this morning, this was the worst mistake of the Reagan presidency. It says here, the Kennedy pick was supposed to calm the waters after the storm generated by the Robert Bork and Douglas Ginsburg nominations. Bork would have been a brilliant justice, but leftists savaged the man, transmogrifying him into an ugly beast, a gargoyle. Bork suffered the ignominy of the likes of Senator Ted Kennedy portraying him as anti-woman. A new verb was introduced into the political lexicon, the process of being borked. That's what happened back in 1987. It says, in the end, Anthony Kennedy got the nod and was sworn in February 18th, 1988. His subsequent 30 years of judicial decisions literally redefined things as basic as life and marriage. Now go back to that quote that I gave you before the break. An event occurred in 1986. And, I mean, this was a major turning point in history. And it's radically altered everything that has happened since. Culture, family, education, religion, science, finance, politics, everything. And here's the American Spectator talking about Kennedy's time on the Supreme Court. 30 years from 1988 to this year. And he had a hand in it. He literally redefined things as basic as life and marriage. His calamitous three decades on the court will be followed by an endless maze of legal cultural wars and church-state battles dealing with the disastrous dust-up of what he unleashed. Some harsh criticism, but then it goes and looks at the history. And really, this the reason I found this article fascinating is because it's more about America. It's more about America since Satan was cast down than it is about Anthony Kennedy. And this author draws attention to two decisions in particular that Anthony Kennedy was part of. The first was the June 1992 case, Planned Parenthood versus Casey, the latter being Pennsylvania's governor, the late Bob Casey Sr., who represented something now near extinct, a pro-life Democrat politician. There used to be pro-life Democrats. Did you know this? A lot has happened to the Democrat Party. A lot has changed since the mid to late 1980s. Casey lost in a 6-3 vote that affirmed a constitutional right to abortion in all 50 states. This pivotal case flatly preserved Roe v. Wade, the infamous 1973 decision. It says, and Kennedy led the majority with one of the most breathtakingly outrageous statements in the history of jurisprudence. This is quoting Anthony Kennedy from that 1992 decision. Kennedy said, "At the heart of liberty is the right to define one's own concept of existence, of meaning, of the universe, and of the mystery of human life." Let me just repeat that, like the author does. At the heart of liberty is the right to define one's own concept of existence, of meaning, of the universe, and of the mystery of human life. Spectator goes on to say, tens of millions of unborn babies would continue to be legally aborted courtesy of that bucket of philosophical hogwash. And hogwash it was. Had Anthony Kennedy been in Philadelphia trying to peddle that buncombe, whatever that means, in 1776, the founders would have either ordered him a straitjacket or chased him out of the hall with torches. Imagine telling John Adams and James Madison that liberty is the right of every individual to define his own meanings of life and existence and the universe and human life. That was plainly not the founder's conception of liberty, nor a Judeo-Christian conception. Adams, you'll recognize this, Adams would have burst at the seams, snapping at Kennedy. Our Constitution was made only for a moral and religious people. It is wholly inadequate to the government of any other. I mean, this is not going to survive. This experiment will not survive. Freedom will not reign without morality and religion. Today, I mean, it's just freedom. Freedom to sin, basically. That's the message coming from the radical left. And with that decision in 1992, well, people were free to continue right on aborting human beings. Tens of millions of them. I want to play for you a clip. This is something, again, it refers to the appointment of Kennedy as being Reagan's worst mistake. But let me play for you what President Reagan said at Georgetown. This was around the same time, October, and as this author brings out, Kennedy would have done well to hearken back to what Mr. Reagan said about freedom. These are remarks he made at Georgetown University on October 1st, 1988. Here's clip six.
At its full flowering, freedom is the first principle of society. This society, Western society. Indeed, from Abraham to Plato, Aristotle to Aquinas, freedom is the animating principle of Western civilization. Now, freedom comes in many guises, in the noble words of the Declaration of Independence and in the noble souls of people like Sharansky. And yet, freedom cannot exist alone. And that's why the theme for your bicentennial is so very apt. Learning, faith, and freedom. Each reinforces the others. Each makes the others possible. For what are they without each other? Learning is a good thing, but unless it's tempered by faith and a love of freedom, it can be very dangerous indeed. The names of many intellectuals are recorded in the rolls of infamy, from Robespierre to Lenin, to Ho Chi Minh, to Pol Pot. We must never forget that wisdom is impossible without learning. But learning does not by the longest measure, bring wisdom. It can also bring evil. What will faith without a respect for learning and an understanding of freedom bring? We've seen the tragedy of untempered faith and the hellish deaths of 14-year-old boys, small hands still wrapped around machine guns on the front lines in Iran. And what will be wrought by freedom unaccompanied by learning and faith? The license of Weimar Germany and the decadence of Imperial Rome. Human behavior untempered by a sense of moral, spiritual, or intellectual limits. The behavior G.K. Chesterton described as the morbid weakness of always sacrificing the normal to the abnormal. And when freedom is mangled in this way, what George Orwell would have called unfreedom soon follows. So we like to believe, and we pray it will always be so, that America is different. That America is what she is because she is guided by all three: learning, faith, and freedom.
Learning, faith, and freedom. What are any of those without the other? Today it's just absolute freedom. And this is why they're crying out that, well, the Constitution is being destroyed. Because they're afraid. They're afraid that their freedom to sin, their freedom to do anything, might in some small ways be curtailed. And of course, that probably won't even happen. Because that's the way they see or view those documents. Now, I mean, it was different a few years ago. A few years ago, it was outdated. It needed to change. But now, in their minds, look, these documents say we deserve freedom. Freedom to abort babies. Freedom to have homosexual marriage. That's the other decision, by the way, that this Spectator piece points to. The June 2015 Obergefell decision. Spectator says, there in one fell swoop, this master of judicial creativity rendered unto himself, speaking of Kennedy and the court, with the help of four liberal friends, the astonishing ability to redefine the multi-millennia natural, biblical, Western, Judeo-Christian conception of marriage. Spectator says, since the dawn of humanity, over 99.99% of human beings who have bestrode the planet shared the consensus that marriage is, by its very nature, between a man and a woman. It's an institution, not ours to change. But that didn't give pause to Kennedy and fellow human nature redefiners. Not in their new America. Not in America after Planned Parenthood versus Casey in 1992, where meanings are subject to the whim of whatever we mean them to mean. And so in Obergefell, rendered on June 26th, 2015, Anthony Kennedy and four liberals took it upon themselves to legally redefine marriage from the bench and impose their judicial fiat upon all 50 states in an unprecedented display of judicial conceit. Kennedy and comrades arrogated unto themselves the right to create their own definition of marriage, a right theretofore restricted to the laws of nature and nature's God. See, what is freedom without faith? These two pillars You can add learning in as well, but like Mr. Reagan brought out. I mean, just intellect alone, even. Well, there's all kinds of intellectuals recorded in the rolls of infamy. And so what about faith? And so what about religion? What about the Judeo-Christian ethic? And all that then together with freedom, as President Reagan was explaining. It says finally in The Spectator, if you were surprised by that spectacle in June 2015, you shouldn't have been in light of the decision in June 1992. Once we've established the right, listen to this again, and think about it in the context of that quote that I gave to you from my father. Something significant happened in 1986. Spectator says, once we've established the right to conjure up our own definition of existence, of meaning, of the universe, and of life itself, then conjuring up our own definition of marriage is small potatoes. Welcome to Anthony Kennedy's America. You see why the liberals are up in arms? You see why they're in the midst of an absolute meltdown? Because they love Anthony Kennedy's America. That's why. They want an America where you decide. That's what Kennedy was saying in that dreadful decision from 92. At the heart of liberty is the right to define one's own concept of existence, of meaning, of the universe, and of the mystery of human life. Spectator says, well, of course, there have been worse Supreme Court justices than Anthony Kennedy. In fact, there's four of them in the Supreme Court right now. But it's hard, it says here, but it's hard to find a worse disappointment than Anthony Kennedy. The entirety of all his good decisions will never outweigh the human damage of his catastrophically bad decisions. And Anthony Kennedy was supposed to be Robert Bork. Robert Bork, he was asked in 2005 by Larry King, what is it that makes a good Supreme Court judge? And Bork said, a willingness to apply the Constitution according to the principles that are actually in it, rather than what they call the evolving or the living Constitution, which simply means that judges begin to make it up. You see why there was such resistance to Robert Bork back in 1987? Bork, he was a former Marine, a law graduate from the University of Chicago, professor at Yale Law School, served as the U.S. Solicitor General during the 1970s, and was a federal judge for a number of years. I forget how many, but when he was confirmed by the Senate as an appellate judge, well, that happened in 1982, the American Bar Association said he was exceptionally well qualified. Exceptionally well qualified. And he was a strict originalist. He believed in upholding the truth of the Constitution. Is that what people want? Is that what we want today? We've got to preserve the Constitution, many are saying. And you'll hear it often from both sides. This is why you've got to dig in a little bit and study. This was President Reagan back in 1987. July 1st, 1987, when he nominated or announced that he would nominate Robert Bork to the Supreme Court. Here's clip one.
But it's with great pleasure and deep respect for his extraordinary abilities that I today announce my intention to nominate United States Court of Appeals Judge Robert H. Bork to be an Associate Justice of the Supreme Court. Judge Bork is recognized as a premier constitutional authority. His outstanding intellect and unrivaled scholarly credentials are reflected in his thoughtful examination of the broad, fundamental legal issues of our times. When confirmed by the Senate as an appellate judge in 1982, The American Bar Association gave him its highest rating, exceptionally well qualified. On the bench, he has been well prepared, even-handed, and open-minded. In taking this action today, I'm mindful of the importance of this nomination. The Supreme Court of the United States is the custodian of our Constitution. Justices of the Supreme Court must not only be jurists of the highest competence, they must be attentive to the specific rights guaranteed in our Constitution and the proper role of the courts in our democratic system. Judge Bork, widely regarded as the most prominent and intellectually powerful advocate of judicial restraint, shares my view that judges' personal preferences and values should not be part of their constitutional interpretations.
That was on July 1st, 1987, President Reagan saying that, look, I'm nominating him because he believes that judges' personal preferences and values should not be part of their constitutional interpretation, the interpretations they make regarding the Constitution. The Constitution speaks for itself. But this man coming on, I mean, it didn't take even but 45 minutes before Senator Edward Kennedy took to the floor in Congress to denounce this nomination. And I don't have it as part of this clip I'll play, but he Kennedy, of all people, he has the gall to go back to events in the 1970s, and he said that what Bork did in the 70s was scandalous. What Bork did in the 70s, not Kennedy. Here's Senator Edward Kennedy denouncing this selection in July of 1987, clip two.
Robert Bork's America is a land in which women would be forced into back alley abortions, blacks would sit at segregated lunch counters, rogue police could break down citizens' doors in midnight raids, and school children could not be taught about evolution. Writers and artists would be censured at the whim of government. And the doors of the federal courts would be shut on the fingers of millions of citizens for whom the judiciary is and is often the only protector of the individual rights that are the heart of our democracy. America is a better and freer nation than Robert Bork thinks. Yet in the current delicate balance of the Supreme Court, his rigid ideology will tip the scales of justice against the kind of country America is and ought to be. The damage that President Reagan will do through this nomination, if it is not rejected by the Senate, could live on far beyond the end of his presidential term. President Reagan is still our president, but he should not be able to reach out from the muck of Irangate, reach into the muck of Watergate, and impose his reactionary vision of the Constitution on the Supreme Court and on the next generation of Americans. No justice would be better than this injustice.
That's Senator Kennedy from 1987. And I mean, then they ganged up on him at the hearings. Those happened in September of 1987. And here at the very beginning, here is, now listen to this. If you want to preserve the Constitution, many are saying that today. Listen to what this man said in 1987 about how a judge ought to behave in the Supreme Court. What his job is. What is a judge's authority? Here's clip three.
The judge's authority derives entirely from the fact that he is applying the law and not his personal values. That is why the American public accepts the decisions of its courts, accepts even decisions that nullify the laws a majority of the electorate or of their representatives voted for. The judge, to deserve that trust and that authority, must be every bit as governed by law as is the Congress, the President, state governors and legislatures, and the American people. No one, including a judge, can be above the law. Only in that way will justice be done and the freedom of Americans assured. How should a judge go about finding the law? The only legitimate way, in my opinion, is by attempting to discern what those who made the law intended. The intentions of the lawmakers govern, whether the lawmakers are the Congress of the United States enacting a statute, or whether they are those who ratified our Constitution and its various amendments. Where the words are precise and the facts simple, that is a relatively easy task. Where the words are general, as is the case with some of the most profound protections of our liberties in the Bill of Rights and in the Civil War amendments, the task is far more complex. It is to find the principle or value that was intended to be protected and to see that it is protected. As I wrote in an opinion for our court, the judge's responsibility is to discern how the framers' values, defined in the context of the world they knew, apply in the world we know.
That's Robert Bork, his opening statement at the hearings in September of 1987, over and again referencing the law. No one's above the law. A judge's job is to apply the law. Now, Kamala Harris, that clip we played at the start, she says, look, the destruction of the Constitution, that's what's happening here. And then what does she talk about throughout that statement? Equality, justice, fairness. Nothing about the law. Nothing about the supreme law of the land. Nothing about the Constitution except that, well, Donald Trump's evidently trashing it. I mean, you listen to some of this. It's fascinating. It's also inspiring. This could have been, this should have been, the Supreme Court justice in 1987. As it was, just like the Spectator brings out, they turned him into a gargoyle. He will abuse women. He will segregate the races. He's in favor of a police state. That's what they were saying. Listen to Bork again talk about what is a judge's duty. Here's clip four.
That duty, I repeat, is to ensure that the powers and freedoms the framers specified are made effective in today's circumstances. But I should add to that passage that when a judge goes beyond this and reads entirely new values into the constitutions, values the framers and the ratifiers did not put there, he deprives the people of their liberty. That liberty, which the Constitution clearly envisions, is the liberty of the people to set their own social agenda through the processes of democracy.
That's what we see happening because of this lawlessness. We're actually losing our liberties, our freedoms. Here again, that same clip. What the framers meant. Pointing back to the framers, the ratifiers, those who ratified the Constitution. In these same hearings, Thomas Sowell came forward to... Thomas Sowell, that right-wing extremist. Thomas Sowell, you listen to Thomas Sowell talk to this day. He's much older now, of course. He's 30-some years older. The many books that he's written. Of course, Bork went on to write many books himself. But this was a younger Thomas Sowell speaking up for Robert Bork during those nomination hearings. Here's clip five.
Gradually but steadily over the past 35 years, more and more decisions have been taken out of the hands of the American people and vested in courts. Those preoccupied with the merits or demerits of the specific issues raised in the cases involved pay little attention to the general drift away from accountable representative government. The ad hoc way many of these landmark cases of this era were based on legal principles improvised for the moment has meant that law itself has become more and more a matter of how judges happen to feel politically or socially about particular issues or particular litigants. No one has opposed these judicial trends more consistently or more ably than Robert H. Bork, first as a scholar, and then as a judge. Mr. Bork has rejected the idea that judges should engage in heroic adventures in policymaking, as he calls it. The renunciation of power, he has said, is the morality of the jurist, not the assumption of power in the name of morality. What Mr. Bork has fought against consistently over the years has been, in his words, government by judges who are not applying the Constitution.
He fought against that. He fought against judges who were not applying the Constitution. He was a strict constitutionalist. And that's why they made him out to be a gargoyle in 1987, over 30 years ago. The Senate Judiciary Committee, they rejected him on October 6th, 1987, 9-5. And yet Bork refused to withdraw at that point. He said, I want a full Senate vote. He knew what the vote would be, in fact. He knew they would vote against him. He said a few days after the Judiciary Committee voted against him, he said, in the 100 days since my nomination, the country has witnessed an unprecedented event. The process of confirming justices for our nation's highest court has been transformed in a way that should not and indeed must not be permitted to occur again. Well, we're going to see it again, I think. He said, the tactics and techniques of national political campaigns have been unleashed on the process of confirming judges. That is not simply disturbing, it's dangerous. Federal judges are not appointed to decide cases according to the latest opinion polls. They are appointed to decide cases impartially according to law. There it is again. According to the law. It says, but when judicial nominees are assessed and treated like political candidates, the effect will be to chill the climate in which judicial deliberations take place, to erode public confidence in the impartiality of courts, and to endanger the independence of the judiciary. He said flatly, in 200 years, no nominee for justice has ever campaigned for that high office. None ever should, and I will not. 2 weeks later, Bork's nomination was rejected by the Senate, 58-42, I believe the vote was. And he wrote later in his book, The Tempting of America, he said that this clash over his nomination, it was simply one battle in this long-running war for control of our legal culture. He said further, there may be legitimate differences about the nomination, but in the larger war for control of the law, there are only two sides. Either the Constitution and statutes are law, which means that their principles are known and control judges, or they are malleable texts that judges may rewrite to see that particular groups or political causes win. Until recently, the American people were largely unaware of the struggle for dominance in law because it was waged in explicit form only in law schools. Now it's coming into the open. Yes, indeed, it came into the open in a big way in 1987. And because of that, he got borked. And America was left with Anthony Kennedy, who wrote in an opinion in 1992 that at the heart of liberty, right at the heart of liberty, is the right to define one's own concept of existence, of meaning, of the universe, and of the mystery of human life. The radical left, I mean, it got its man back in 1987. And you see, in looking back on this history, you see with these decisions, protecting abortion in 1992. Abortion? And people tweeting out today, look, I'm going to give you a free abortion before it's too late, before you can't do it anymore. Just horrible. I mean, imagine this in the time of the founders, the framers. Or redefining marriage, taking it upon yourself, five individuals in black robes saying, you know what, marriage has been defined like this for millennia, but we've decided
that we can define our own concept of existence. We can define the mystery of human life. We can redefine marriage if we need to. And so they did. Welcome to Anthony Kennedy's America. Well, we'll have to see who it is that replaces Kennedy and whether or not it is a strict originalist or someone that would please the radical left or someone in between. But in so many ways, the damage has already been done. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you tomorrow.